Varney, who had stumbled to his feet, picked up the crowbar with his mind. The Marquis watched him do it, and he said nothing. The ghost of a smile hovered about Dawes' lips. "That's funny," she said. "Richard thought you were a..." Hunter never found out what Richard thought she was. The bar came hurtling toward her head. She simply reached out a hand and caught it. It thwapped, satisfyingly, into the palm of her hand. She walked over to Varney. "Is this yours?" she asked. He bared his teeth at her, yellow and black and brown. "Right now," said Hunter, "we're under market truce. But if you try something like that again, I'll waive the truce, and I'll break off both your arms and make you carry them home in your teeth." "Now," she continued, bending his wrist behind his back, "say sorry, nicely."
"Ow,"
said Varney.
"Yes," she said, encouragingly.
He spat it out as if it were choking him.
"I'm sorry."
She let him go. Varney backed away to a safe distance, plainly scared and furious, his face toward Hunter. And when he reached the door to the food halls, he hesitated and shouted,
"You're dead! You're fucking dead, you are!"
in a voice that hovered on the edge of tears. And then he turned and he ran from the room.
"Amateurs,"
sighed Hunter. They walked back through the store the way that Richard had come. The bell was now tolling deeply and continually. When they came upon it, he saw that it was a huge brass bell suspended on a wooden frame, with a rope suspended from the clapper. It was being tolled by a large black man, wearing the black robes of a Dominican monk, and it had been set up next to Harrod's gourmet jelly bean stand. Impressive as the market had been to watch, Richard found it even more impressive to see the speed at which it was being dismantled, broken down, and put away. All evidence that it had ever been there was vanishing. Stalls were being taken apart, loaded onto people's backs, hauled off into the streets. Richard noticed Old Bailey, his arms filled with his crude signs and with bird cages, stumbling out of the store. The old man waved happily at Richard and vanished off into the night. The crowds thinned. The market vanished, and the ground floor of Harrod's looked as usual, as sedate, as proper, and as clean as any time he had walked around it in Jessica's wake on a Saturday afternoon. It was as if the market had never existed.
"Hunter," said the Marquis, "I've heard of you, of course. Where have you been all this time?"
"Hunting," she said simply. Then to Dawes.
"Can you take orders?"
Dawes nodded.
"If I have to."
"Good.
Then maybe I can keep you alive," said Hunter, "if I take the job."
The Marquis stopped. His eyes flickered over her distrustfully.
You said if you take the job?"
Hunter opened the door, and they stepped out onto the pavement of London at night. It had rained while they'd been at the market, and the street lights now glimmered on the wet tarmac.
"I've taken it,"
said Hunter. Richard stared at the glistening street. It all seemed so normal, so quiet, so sane. For a moment he felt that all he needed to get his life back would be to hail a taxi and tell it to take him home. And then he would sleep the night through in his own bed. But a taxi would not see him or stop for him, and he had nowhere to go, even if one did.
"I'm tired," he said.
No one said anything. Dawes would not meet his eyes. The Marquis was cheerfully ignoring him, and Hunter was treating him as an irrelevance. He felt like a small child, unwanted, following the bigger children around, and that made him irritated.
Look, he said, I don't want to be a bother or anything. I know you are all very busy people, but what about me? The Marquis turned and stared at him, eyes huge and white in his dark face. You, he said. What about you?
Well, said Richard, how do I get back to normal again? It's like I've walked into a nightmare. Last week, everything made sense, and now nothing makes sense.
He trailed off, swallowed.
I want to know how to get my life back, he explained.
You won't get it back travelling with us, Richard, said Dor. It's going to be hard enough for you anyway. I really am sorry.
Hunter, in the lead, knelt down on the pavement. She took a small metal object from her belt and used it to unlock the cover to a sewer. She pulled up the sewer cover, looked into it warily, climbed down, then ushered Dor into the sewer. Dor did not look at Richard as she went down. The Marquis scratched the side of his nose.
Young man, he said, understand this. There are two Londons. There's London above, that's where you lived, and then there's London below, the underside, inhabited by the people who fell through the cracks in the world. Now, you're one of them. Good night.
He began to climb down the sewer ladder. Richard said, hang on, and caught the sewer cover before it could close. He followed the Marquis down. It smelled like drains at the top of the sewer, a dead, soapy, cabbagey smell. He expected it to get worse as he went down, but instead the smell quickly dissipated as he approached the floor of the sewer. Grey water ran, shallow but fast, along the bottom of the brick tunnel. Richard stepped into it. He could see the lights of the others up ahead, and he ran and splashed down the tunnel until he caught up with them.
"Go away," said the Marquis.
"No," he said.
Dor glanced up at him.
"I am really sorry, Richard," she said.
The Marquis stepped between Richard and Dor. "You can't go back to your old home, or your old job, or your old life," he said to Richard, almost gently. "None of those things exist. Up there, you don't exist."
They had reached a junction, a place where three tunnels came together. Dor and Hunter set off along one of them, the one that no water was coming down, and they did not look back. The Marquis lingered.
"You'll just have to make the best of it down here," he said to Richard, "in the sewers and the magic and the dark."
And then he smiled, hugely, whitely, a gleaming grin, monumental in its insincerity.
"Well, delightful to see you again. Best of luck. If you can survive for the next day or two," he confided, "you might even make it through a whole month."
And with that, he turned and strode off through the sewer, after Dor and Hunter. Richard leaned against a wall and listened to their footsteps echoing away, and to the rush of the water running past on its way to the pumping stations of East London and the sewage works.
"Shit," he said.
And then, to his surprise, for the first time since his father died, alone in the dark, Richard Mayhew began to cry. The underground station was quite empty and quite dark. Varney walked through it, keeping close to walls, darting nervous looks behind him and in front of him and from side to side. He had picked the station at random, had headed for it over the rooftops and through the shadows, making certain that he was not being followed. He was not heading back to his lair in the Camden Town deep tunnels. Too risky. There were other places in which Varney had cached weapons and food. He would go to ground for a little while, until this all blew over. He stopped beside a ticket machine and listened in the darkness. Absolute silence. Reassured that he was alone, he allowed himself to relax. He stopped at the top of the spiral staircase and drew a deep breath. A voice from beside him, oleaginous as sump oil, said conversationally,
"Varney's the finest bravo and guard in the underside. Everyone knows that. Mr. Varney told us so himself."
And a voice from the other side of him responded dully, "It's not nice to lie, Mr. Croup." In the pitch darkness, Mr. Croup warmed to his theme.
"It isn't, Mr. Vandemar. I have to say, I regard it as a personal betrayal, and I was deeply wounded by it, and disappointed. When you don't have any redeeming features, you don't take particularly kindly to disappointment, do you, Mr. Vandemar?"
"Not kindly at all, Mr. Croup." Varney threw himself forward and ran headlong in the dark down the spiral staircase. A voice from the top of the stairs, Mr. Croup's.
"Really," it said, "we ought to look upon it as a mercy killing."
The sound of Varney's feet clattered off the metal railings, echoed throughout the stairwell. He puffed and he panted, his shoulders glancing off the walls, tumbling blindly downwards in the dark. He reached the bottom of the steps next to the sign warning travellers that there were 259 steps up to the top, and only healthy people should even think about attempting it. Everyone else, suggested the sign, should use the elevator. The elevator. Something clanked. And the elevator doors opened magnificently slowly, flooding the passageway with light. Varney fumbled for his knife, cursed when he realized the hunter bitch still had it. He reached for the machete in his shoulder sheath. It was gone. He heard a polite cough behind him, and he turned. Mr. Vandemar was sitting on the steps at the bottom of the spiral staircase. He was picking his fingernails with Varney's machete. And then Mr. Croup fell upon him, all teeth and talons and little blades, and Varney never had a chance to scream. "Bye," said Mr. Vandemar impassively, and he continued paring his nails. After that, the blood began to flow. Wet, red blood, in enormous quantities. For Varney was a big man, and he had been keeping it all inside. When Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar were finished, however, one would have been hard put even to notice the slight stain on the floor at the bottom of the spiral staircase. The next time the floors were washed, it was gone forever. Hunter was in the lead. Dor walked in the middle. The Marquis de Carabas took up the rear. None of them had said a word since they had left Richard half an hour earlier. Dor stopped suddenly. "We can't do this," she said flatly. "We can't leave him back there." "Of course we can," said the Marquis. "We did." She shook her head. She had felt guilty and stupid since she saw Richard lying on his back beneath Ryslip at the audition. She was tired of it.
"Don't be foolish," said the Marquis.
"He saved my life," she told him. "He could have left me on the sidewalk. He didn't." It was her fault. She knew that was true. She had opened a door to someone who could help her, and help her he had. He had taken her somewhere warm, and he had cared for her, and he had brought her help. The action of helping her had tumbled him from his world into hers. It was foolish to even think about bringing him with them. They could not afford to bring someone with them. She was unsure that the three of them would be able to take care of themselves on the journey that confronted them. She wondered, briefly, if it was simply the door that she had opened that had taken her to him, which had allowed him to notice her, or if there were, somehow, more to it than that. The Marquis raised an eyebrow. He was detached, removed, a creature of pure irony. "My dear young lady," he said, We are not bringing a passenger along on this expedition.
Don't patronize me, De Carabas, said Dor. She sounded tired.
And I think I can decide who comes with us. You are working for me, aren't you? Or is it the other way round?
Her sorrow and exhaustion had drained her of her patience.
She needed De Carabas. She couldn't afford to drive him away. But she had reached her limit.
De Carabas stared at her, coldly angry.
He is not coming with us, he stated, flatly. Anyway, he's probably dead by now.
Richard was not dead. He was sitting in the dark, on a ledge, on the side of a storm drain, wondering what to do, wondering how much further out of his depth he could possibly get.
His life, so far, he decided, had prepared him perfectly for a job in securities, for shopping at the supermarket, for watching football on the telly on the weekends, for turning on a heater if he got cold. It had magnificently failed to prepare him for life as an unperson, on the roofs and in the sewers of London, for a life in the cold and the wet and the dark.
A light glimmered. Footsteps came toward him. If, he decided, it was a bunch of murderers, cannibals or monsters, he would not even put up a fight. Let them end it all for him. He'd had enough. He stared down into the dark, to the place where his feet should be. The footsteps came closer.
Richard?
The voice was Dawes. He jumped. Then he studiously ignored her.
If it wasn't for you, he thought.
Richard? He didn't look up.
What?
He said.
Look, she said, you really wouldn't be in this mess if it weren't for me.
You can see that again, he thought.
And I really don't think you'll be any safer with us, but, well,
she stopped, a deep breath.
I'm sorry, I really am. Are you coming?
He looked at her then, a small elfin girl, with huge opal-coloured eyes staring at him urgently from a heart-shaped pale face.
Okay, he said to himself, I guess I'm not quite ready to just give up and die.
Well, I don't have anywhere else to be right now, he said, with a studied unconcern that bordered on hysteria.
Why not?
Her face changed. She threw her arms around his chest and hugged him tightly.
And we will try to get you back home again, she said. Promise. Once we've found what I'm looking for.
He wondered if she meant it. Suspected, for the first time, that what she was offering might be impossible. But he pushed that thought out of his head. They began to walk down the tunnel. Richard could see Hunter and the Marquis waiting for them at the tunnel's mouth. The Marquis looked as if he had been forced to swallow a pulped lemon.
"What are you looking for, anyway?"
asked Richard, cheering up a little.
Dor took a deep breath
and answered after a long pause.
"It's a long story," she said solemnly. "Right now, we're looking for an angel named Islington."
It was then that Richard began to laugh. He couldn't help himself. There was hysteria in there, certainly, but there was also the exhaustion of someone who had managed, somehow, to believe several dozen impossible things in the last 24 hours without ever getting a proper breakfast. His laughter echoed down the tunnels.
"An angel," he said, giggling helplessly. "Called Islington."
"We've got a long way to go," said Dor. And Richard shook his head and felt wrung out and emptied and flayed.
"An angel,"
he whispered hysterically to the tunnels and the dark.
"An angel."
There were candles all over the great hall.
Candles stood by the iron pillars that held the roof up. Candles waited by the waterfall that ran down one wall and into the small rock pool below. Candles clustered on the sides of the rock wall. Candles huddled on the floor. Candles were set into candlesticks by the huge door that stood between two dark iron pillars. The door was built of polished black flint, set into a silver base that had tarnished over the centuries, almost to black in its turn. The candles were unlit, but as the tall form walked past, they flickered into flame. No hand touched them. No fires touched their wicks. The figure's robe was simple and white, or more than white, a colour or an absence of all colours, so bright as to be startling. Its feet were bare on the cold rock floor of the great hall. Its face was pale and wise and gentle, and perhaps a little lonely. It was very beautiful. Soon, every candle in the hall was burning. It paused by the rock pool, knelt beside the water, cupped its hands, lowered them into the clear water, raised them, and drank. The water was cold, but very pure. When it had finished drinking the water, it closed its eyes for a moment, as if in benediction. Then it stood up and walked away, back through the hall, the way it had come. And the candles went out as it passed, as they had done for tens of thousands of years. It had no wings, but still it was, unmistakably, an angel. Islington left the great hall, and the last of the candles went out, and the darkness returned. Chapter 6 Richard wrote a diary entry in his head. "Dear Diary," he began, "on Friday I had a job, a fiancé, a home, and a life that made sense, well, as much as any life makes sense. Then I found an injured girl bleeding on the pavement, and I tried to be a good Samaritan. Now I've got no fiancé, no home, no job, and I'm walking around a couple of hundred feet under the streets of London with the projected life expectancy of a suicidal mayfly." "This way," said the Marquis, gesturing elegantly, his filthy lace cuff flowing. "Don't all these tunnels look the same?" asked Richard, tabling his diary entry for the moment. "How can you tell which is which?"
"You can't," said the Marquis, sadly. "We're hopelessly lost. We'll never be seen again. In a couple of days, we'll be killing each other for food."
"Really?" He hated himself for rising to the bait, even as he said it. "No." The Marquis's expression said that torturing this poor fool was too easy to even be amusing. Richard found that he cared less and less what these people thought of him, however, except, perhaps, for Dor. He went back to writing his mental diary. "There are hundreds of people in this other London, thousands maybe, people who come from here, or people who have fallen through the cracks. I'm wandering around with a girl called Dor, her bodyguard, and her psychotic Grand Vizier. We slept last night in a small tunnel that Dor said was once a section of Regency sewer. The bodyguard was awake when I went to sleep, and awake when they woke me up. I don't think she ever sleeps. We had some fruitcake for breakfast. The Marquis had a large lump of it in his pocket." Why would anyone have a large lump of fruitcake in his pocket? "My shoes dried out mostly while I slept. I want to go home." Then he mentally underlined the last sentence three times, rewrote it in huge letters in red ink, and circled it, before putting a number of exclamation marks next to it in his mental margin. At least the tunnel they were now walking down was dry. It was a high-tech tunnel, all silvery pipes and white walls. The Marquis and Orr walked together in front. Richard tended to stay a couple of paces behind them. Hunter moved about. Sometimes she was behind them, sometimes to one side of them or to the other, often a little way in front, merging with the shadows. She made no sound when she moved, which Richard found rather disconcerting. There was a crack of light ahead of them. "There we go," said the Marquis. "Bank station. Good place to start looking."
"You're out of your mind," said Richard.
He did not mean it to be heard, but the most sotto of voces carried and echoed in the darkness.
"Indeed," said the Marquis.
The ground began to rumble. An underground train was somewhere close at hand.
"Richard, just leave it," said Dor.
But it was coming out of his mouth.
"Well," he said, "you're both being silly. There are no such things as angels."
The Marquis nodded, said, "Ah, yes, I understand you now.
There are no such things as angels, just as there is no London below, no rat speakers, no shepherds in Shepherd's Bush. There are no shepherds in Shepherd's Bush. I've been there. It's just houses and shops and roads and the BBC, that's all,"
pointed out Richard flatly. "There are shepherds," said Hunter from the darkness just next to Richard's ear. "Pray you never meet them." She sounded perfectly serious.
"Well," said Richard, "I still don't believe that there are flocks of angels wandering about down here."
"There aren't,"
said the Marquis.
"Just one."
They had reached the end of the tunnel. There was a locked door in front of them. The Marquis stood back.
"My lady," he said to Dor.
She rested a hand on it for a moment. The door opened, silently.
"Maybe," Richard said, persisting, "we're thinking of different things. The angels I have in mind are all wings, halos, trumpets, peace on earth, goodwill unto men."
"That's right," said Dor. "You got it. Angels." They went through the door. Richard shut his eyes involuntarily at the sudden flood of light. It stabbed into his head like a migraine. As his eyes became used to the light, Richard found, to his surprise, that he knew where he was. They were in the long pedestrian tunnel that links Monument and Bank tube stations. There were commuters wandering through the tunnels, none of whom gave the four of them even a first look. The perky wail of a saxophone echoed along the tunnel. Burt Bacharach and Hal David's "I'll Never Fall in Love Again," being played more or less competently. Richard successfully fought the urge to hum along. They walked toward Bank Station.
"Who are we looking for again, then?" he asked, more or less innocently.
The angel Gabriel? Raphael? Michael?"
They were passing a tube map. The Marquis tapped Angel Station with one long dark finger. Islington. Richard had passed through Angel Station hundreds of times. It was in trendy Islington, a district filled with antique shops and places to eat. He knew very little about angels, but he was almost certain that Islington's tube stop was named after a pub or a landmark. He changed the subject.
"You know, when I tried to get on a tube train a couple of days ago, it wouldn't let me."
"You just have to let them know who's boss, that's all," said Hunter softly from behind him. Dor chewed her lower lip.
"This train we're looking for will let us on," she said, "if we can find it."
Her words were almost drowned out by music coming from somewhere nearby. They went down a handful of steps and turned a corner. The saxophone player had his coat in front of him on the floor of the tunnel. On the coat were a few coins, which looked as if the man had placed them there himself to persuade passers-by that everyone was doing it. Nobody was fooled. The saxophone player was extremely tall. He had shoulder-length dark hair and a long forked dark beard which framed deep-set eyes and a serious nose. He wore a ragged T-shirt and oil-stained blue jeans. As the travelers reached him, he stopped playing, shook the spit from the saxophone mouthpiece, replaced it, and went into the old Julie London song, Cry Me a River. Now you say you're sorry. Richard realized with surprise that the man could see them, and also that he was doing his best to pretend that he couldn't. The Marquis stopped in front of him. The wail of the saxophone trailed off in a nervous squeak. The Marquis flashed a cold grin. "It's Lear, isn't it?" he asked. The man nodded warily. His fingers stroked the keys of his saxophone. "We're after Earl's Court," continued the Marquis. "Would you happen to have such a thing as a train timetable about your person?" Richard was beginning to catch on. He assumed that the Earl's Court, to which he referred, wasn't the familiar tube station he had waited in innumerable times, reading a paper or just daydreaming. The man named Lear moistened his lips with the tip of his tongue. "'S not impossible. What'd be in it for me, if I did?" The Marquis thrust his hands deep into the pockets of his coat. And then he smiled, like a cat who had just been entrusted with the keys to a home for wayward but plump canaries. "They say," he said, idly, as if he were simply passing the time, "that Merlin's master, Blaise, once wrote a reel so beguiling that it would charm the coins from the pockets of anyone who heard it." Lear's eyes narrowed. "That'd be worth more than just a timetable," he said, "if you actually had it." The Marquis did a perfectly good impression of someone realizing that, my, it would, wouldn't it? "Well then," he said magnanimously, "I suppose you would have to owe me, wouldn't you?" Lear nodded, reluctantly. He fumbled in his back pocket, pulled out a much-folded scrap of paper, and held it up. The Marquis reached for it. Lear moved his hand away. "Let me hear the reel first, you old trickster," he said, "and it had better work." The Marquis raised an eyebrow. He darted a hand into one of the inside pockets of his coat. When he pulled it out again, it was holding a penny whistle and a small crystal ball. He looked at the crystal ball, made the kind of noise that means, "Ah, so that's where that went," and put it away again. Then he flexed his fingers, put the penny whistle to his lips, and began to play an odd, rollicking tune that leapt and twisted and sang. It made Richard feel as if he were 13 years old again, listening to his best friend's transistor radio at school in the lunch hour, listening to the Top 20 back when pop music had mattered as it only can in your early teenage years. The Marquis' reel was everything he had ever wanted to hear in a song. A handful of coins chinked onto Lear's coat, thrown by passers-by who walked on with a smile on their faces and a spring in their step. The Marquis lowered his penny whistle. "I owe you, then, you old rascal," said Lear, nodding. "Yes, you do." The Marquis took the paper, the timetable, from Lear, and scanned it, and nodded. "But a word to the wise, don't overuse it. A little goes a very long way." And the four of them walked away, down the long corridor, surrounded by posters advertising films and underwear, and the occasional official-looking notices warning buskers away from the station, listening to the sob of the saxophone and to the sound of money landing on a coat. The Marquis led them to a central line platform. Richard walked over to the edge of the platform and looked down. He wondered, as he always did, which one the live rail was, and decided, as he always did, that it was the one farthest from the platform, with the large whitish porcelain insulators between it and the ground. And then he found himself smiling, involuntarily, at a tiny dark grey mouse who was bravely prowling the tracks 3 feet below him in a mousy quest for abandoned sandwiches and dropped potato chips. A voice came over the loudspeaker, that formal, disembodied male voice that warned, "Mind the gap." It was intended to keep unwary passengers from stepping into the space between the train and the platform. Richard, like most Londoners, barely heard it anymore. It was like oral wallpaper. But suddenly Hunter's hand was on his arm. "Mind the gap," she said urgently to Richard. "Stand back over there, by the wall." "What?" said Richard. "I said," said Hunter, "mind the..." And then it erupted over the side of the platform. It was diaphanous, dreamlike, a ghost thing, the colour of black smoke, and it welled up like silk under water, and moving astonishingly fast while still seeming to drift almost in slow motion. It wrapped itself tightly around Richard's ankle. It stung, even through the fabric of his Levi's. The thing pulled him toward the edge of the platform, and he staggered. He realized, as if from a distance, that Hunter had pulled out her staff and was smacking the tentacle with it hard, repeatedly. There was a faraway screaming noise, thin and mindless, like an idiot child deprived of its toy. The smoke tentacle let go of Richard's ankle and slid back over the edge of the platform, and it was gone. Hunter took Richard by the scruff of the neck and pulled him toward the back wall where Richard slumped against it. He was trembling, and the world seemed suddenly utterly unreal. The colour had been sucked from his jeans, wherever the thing had touched him, making them look as if they'd been ineptly tie-dyed. He pulled up the trouser leg. Tiny purple welts were coming up on the skin of his ankle and calf. "What?" he tried to say, but nothing came out. He swallowed and tried again. "What was that?" Hunter looked down at him impassively. Her face could have been carved from brown wood. "I don't think it has a name," she said. "They live in the gaps. I did warn you." "I've never seen one before." "You weren't part of the underside before," said Hunter. "Just wait by the wall. It's safer." The Marquis was checking the time on a large gold pocket watch. He returned it to his waistcoat pocket, consulted the paper Lear had given him, and nodded, satisfied. "We're in luck," he pronounced. "The Earl's Court train should be coming through here in about half an hour." "Earl's Court station isn't on the central line," pointed out Richard. The Marquis stared at Richard, openly amused. "What a refreshing mind you have, young man," he said. "There really is nothing quite like total ignorance, is there?" The warm wind began to blow. An underground train pulled up at the station. People got off, and other people got on, going about the business of their lives, and Richard watched them with envy. "Mind the gap," intoned a recorded voice. "Stand clear of the doors. Mind the gap." Dor took one look at Richard. Then, worried about what she was seeing, she walked over to him and she took his hand. He was very pale, and his breath was coming shallow and fast. "Mind the gap," boomed the recorded voice again. "I'm fine," lied Richard bravely. To no one in particular. The central well at Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar's hospital was a dank and cheerless place. Ragged grass grew up through the abandoned desks, rubber tires and bits of office furniture. The overall impression given by the area was that a decade before, perhaps out of boredom, perhaps out of frustration, perhaps even as a statement or as performance art, a number of people had thrown the contents of their offices out of their windows, high above, and they had left them there to rot. There was broken glass there as well, broken glass in abundance. There were also several mattresses, for no easily explicable reason. Some of these mattresses had, at some point, been set on fire. No one knew why. No one cared. Grass grew up through the springs. An entire ecology had evolved around the ornamental fountain in the centre of the well, which had, for a long time, been neither particularly ornamental nor a fountain. A cracked and leaking water pipe nearby had, with the aid of some rainwater, transformed it into a breeding ground for a number of little frogs, who plopped about cheerfully, rejoicing in their freedom from any non-airborne natural predators. Crows and blackbirds and even occasional seagulls, on the other hand, regarded the place as a cat-free delicatessen with a special on frogs. Slugs sprawled indolently under the springs of the burnt mattresses. Snails left slime trails across the broken glass. Large black beetles scuttled industriously over the smashed grey plastic telephones and mysteriously mutilated Barbie dolls. Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar had come up for a change of air. They were walking slowly around the perimeter of the central yard, broken glass crunching beneath their feet. They looked like shadows in their frayed black suits. Mr. Croup was in a cold fury. He was walking twice as fast as Mr. Vandemar, circling him and almost dancing in his anger. At times, as if unable to contain the rage inside, Mr. Croup would fling himself at the hospital wall, physically attack it with his fists and feet, as if it were a poor substitute for a real person. Mr. Vandemar, on the other hand, simply walked. It was too consistent, too steady and inexorable a walk to be described as a stroll. Death walks like Mr. Vandemar. Mr. Vandemar watched Mr. Croup impassively as Mr. Croup kicked the sheet of glass which had been leaning against a wall. It shattered with a satisfying crash.
"I, Mr. Vandemar," said Mr. Croup, surveying the wreckage. "I, for one, have had almost as much as I'm willing to take. Almost. Pussy-frutting, trifling, lollygagging, shilly-shallying, whey-faced toad. I could pop out his eyes with my thumbs."
Mr. Vandemar shook his head. "Not yet," he said. "He's our boss for this job. After we'd been paid, maybe we could have some fun on our own time." Mr. Croup spat on the ground.
"He's a worthless, conniving dunderhead. We should butcher the bitch. Annul, cancel, inhume, and amortize her."
A telephone began to ring loudly. Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar looked around, puzzled. Eventually, Mr. Vandemar found the telephone halfway down a pile of rubble on top of a scree of water-stained medical records. Broken wires trailed from the back of it. He picked it up and passed it to Mr. Croup.
"For you," he said.
Mr. Vandemar did not like telephones.
"Mr. Croup here," said Croup.
Then, obsequiously,
"Oh, it's you, sir."
A pause.
"At present, as you requested, she is walking around free as a daisy. I'm afraid your bodyguard idea went down like a dead baboon. Varney? Oh, yes, he's quite dead. Another pause. Sir, I am commencing to have certain conceptual problems with the role of myself and my partner in these shenanigans.
There was a third pause, and Mr. Croup went paler than pale.
Unprofessional? He asked mildly. Us?
He curled his hand into a fist, which he slammed, rather hard, into the side of a brick wall. There was no change, however, in his tone of voice as he said,
Sir, might I with due respect remind you that Mr. Vandemar and myself burned down the city of Troy? We brought the Black Plague to Flanders. We have assassinated a dozen kings, 5 popes, 50 heroes, and 2 accredited gods. Our last commission before this was the torturing to death of an entire monastery in 16th century Tuscany. We are utterly professional.
Mr. Vandemar, who had been amusing himself by catching little frogs and seeing how many he could stuff into his mouth at a time before he was forced to start chewing, said, with his mouth full,
I liked doing that.
My point? Asked Mr. Croup, and he flicked some imaginary dust from his threadbare black suit, ignoring the real dust as he did so. My point is that we are assassins. We are cutthroats. We kill.
He listened to something, then,
Well, what about the upworlder? Why can't we kill him?
Mr. Croup twitched, and he spat once more and he kicked the wall as he stood there holding the rust-stained, half-broken telephone.
Scare her? We're cutthroats, not scarecrows!
A pause. He took a deep breath.
Yes, I understand, but I don't like it.
But the person at the other end of the phone had hung up. Mr. Croup looked down at the telephone. Then he hefted it in one hand and proceeded methodically to smash it to shards of plastic and metal by banging it against the wall. Mr. Vandemar walked over. He had found a large black slug with a bright orange underbelly, and he was chewing it like a fat licorice cigar. The slug, which was not very bright, was trying to crawl away down Mr. Vandemar's chin.
Who was that? Asked Mr. Vandemar.
Who the hell do you think it was?
Mr. Vandemar chewed, thoughtfully, then sucked the slug into his mouth like a strand of thick, glutinous black and orange spaghetti.
A scarecrow man?
He ventured.
Our employer!
That was going to be my next guess.
Scarecrows,
spat Mr. Croup, disgusted. He was moving from a red rage to an oily grey sulk. Mr. Vandemar swallowed the contents of his mouth and wiped his lips on his sleeve.
Best way to scare crows, said Mr. Vandemar. You just creep up behind them and put your hand round their little crow necks. And squeeze until they don't move any more. That scares the stuffing out of them.
And then he was silent, and from far above they heard the sound of crows flying, cawing angrily.
Crows! Family Corvidae. Collective noun,
intoned Mr. Croup, relishing the sound of the word.
A murder.
Richard waited against the wall, next to door. She said very little. She chewed her fingernails, ran her hands through her reddish hair until it was sticking up in all directions, then tried to push it back down again. She was certainly unlike anyone he had ever known. When she noticed him looking at her, She shrugged and shimmied down further into her layers of clothes, deeper into her leather jacket. Her face looked out at the world from inside the jacket. The expression on her face made Richard think of a beautiful homeless child he had seen the previous winter behind Covent Garden. He had not been certain whether it was a girl or a boy. Its mother was begging, pleading with the passers-by for coins to feed the child and the infant that she carried in her arms. But the child stared out at the world and said nothing, although it must have been cold and hungry. It just stared. Hunter stood by door, looking back and forth down the platform. The Marquis had told them where to wait and had slipped away. From somewhere, Richard heard a baby begin to cry. The Marquis slipped out of an exit-only door and walked toward them. He was chewing on a piece of candy. "Having fun?" asked Richard. A train was coming towards them, its approach heralded by a gust of warm wind.
"Just taking care of business," said the Marquis.
He consulted the piece of paper and his watch. He pointed to a place on the platform.
"This should be the Earl's Court train. Stand behind me here, you three."
Then, as the underground train, a rather boring-looking, normal train, Richard was disappointed to observe, rumbled and rattled its way into the station. The Marquis leaned across Richard and said to Dor,
"My lady, there is something that perhaps I should have mentioned earlier."
She turned her odd-coloured eyes on him.
"Yes?"
"Well," he said, "the Earl might not be entirely pleased to see me." The train slowed down and stopped. The carriage that had pulled up in front of Richard was quite empty. Its lights were turned off. It was bleak and empty and dark. From time to time, Richard had noticed carriages like this one locked and shadowy on tube trains, and had wondered what purpose they served. The other doors on the train hissed open, and passengers got on and got off. The doors of the darkened carriage remained closed. The Marquis drummed on the door with his fist an intricate rhythmic rap. Nothing happened. Richard was just wondering if the train would now pull out without them on it, when the door of the dark carriage was pushed open from the inside. It opened about 6 inches, and an elderly, bespectacled face peered out at them.
"Who knocks?" he said.
Through the opening, Richard could see flames burning, and people and smoke inside the car. Through the glass in the doors, however, he still saw a dark and empty carriage.
"The Lady Dor," said the Marquis, smoothly. "And her companions."
The door slid open all the way, and they were in Earl's Court. Chapter 7. There was straw scattered on the floor over a layer of rushes. There was an open log fire, sputtering and blazing in a large fireplace. There were a few chickens, strutting and pecking on the floor. There were seats with hand-embroidered cushions on them, and there were tapestries covering the windows and the doors. Richard stumbled forward as the train lurched out of the station. He reached out, grabbed hold of the nearest person, and regained his balance. The nearest person happened to be a short, grey, elderly man-at-arms, who would have looked, Richard decided, exactly like a recently retired government employee, were it not for the tin hat, the surcoat, the rather clumsily knitted chainmail, and the spear. Instead, he looked like a recently retired government employee who had, somewhat against his will, been dragooned into his local amateur dramatic society, where he had been forced to play a man-at-arms. The little grey man blinked short-sightedly at Richard as Richard grabbed him, and then he said lugubriously,
"Sorry about that."
"My fault," said Richard.
"I know," said the man.
An enormous Irish wolfhound padded down the aisle and stopped beside a lute player who sat on the floor, picking at a gladsome melody in a desultory fashion. The wolfhound glared at Richard, snorted with disdain, then lay down and went to sleep. At the far end of the carriage, an elderly falconer, with a hooded falcon on his wrist, was exchanging pleasantries with a small knot of damosels of a certain age. Some passengers obviously stared at the four travellers, others just as obviously ignored them. It was, Richard realised, as if someone had taken a small medieval court and put it, as best they could, in one carriage of an underground train. A herald raised his bugle to his lips and played a tuneless blast as an immense elderly man in a huge fur-lined dressing gown and carpet slippers staggered through the connecting door to the next compartment, his arm resting on the shoulder of a jester in shabby motley. The old man was larger than life in every way. He wore an eye patch over his left eye, which had the effect of making him look slightly helpless and unbalanced, like a one-eyed hawk. There were fragments of food in his red-grey beard, and what appeared to be pajama pants were visible at the bottom of his shabby fur gown. "That," thought Richard, correctly, "must be the Earl." The Earl's jester, an elderly man with a pinched, humourless mouth and a painted face, looked like he had fled from a life as an all-round entertainer near the bottom of the bill on the Victorian music halls 100 years before. He led the Earl to a throne-like carved wooden seat, in which, a trifle unsteadily, the Earl sat down. The wolfhound got up, padded down the length of the carriage, and settled itself at the Earl's slippered feet. "Earl's Court," thought Richard. "Of course." And then he began to wonder whether there was a baron in Baron's Court tube station, or a raven in Raven's Court, or... The little old man-at-arms coughed asthmatically and said, "Right then, you lot, state your business." Dor stepped forward. She held her head up high, suddenly seeming taller and more at ease than Richard had previously seen her, and she said, "We seek an audience with His Grace, the Earl." The Earl called down the carriage. "What did the little girl say, Halvard?" he asked. Richard wondered if he were deaf. Halvard, the elderly man at arms, shuffled around and cupped his hand to his mouth. "They seek an audience, Your Grace," he shouted over the rattle of the train. The Earl pushed aside his thick fur cap and scratched his head meditatively. He was balding underneath his cap. "They do? An audience? How splendid! Who are they, Halvard?" Halvard turned back to them. "He wants to know who you all are. Keep it short, though. Don't go on." "I am the Lady Dor," announced Dor. "The Lord Portico was my father." The Earl brightened at this, leaned forward, peered through the smoke with his one good eye. "Did she say she was Portico's oldest girl?" he asked the jester. "Yes, Your Grace." The Earl beckoned to Dor. "Come here," he said. Come. Let me look at you." She walked down the swaying carriage, grabbing the thick rope straps that hung from the ceiling as she went to keep her balance. When she stood before the Earl's wooden chair, she curtsied. He scratched at his beard and stared at her. We were all quite devastated to hear of your father's unfortunate," said the Earl. And then he interrupted himself and said, "Well, all your family, it was a..." And he trailed off and said, "You know, I had the warmest regards for him. Did a bit of business together. Good old Portico, full of ideas." He stopped. Then he tapped the jester on the shoulder and whispered in a querulous boom, loud enough that it could be heard easily over the noise of the train,
Go and make jokes at them, Tully. Earn your keep.
The Earl's fool staggered up the aisle with an arthritic mop and a rheumatic mow. He stopped in front of Richard.
And